When we found out Timothy was going to do something different, be gone for 2 weeks, he was going to look for a substitute. We decided he could look for a substitute. And I went home after the shepherd's meeting that night, laid down, and the message, a servant's heart, started going through my head. For no reason. Well, for one reason. And I finally said, okay, I hear you. And I talked to Timothy and said, okay, yeah, don't worry about finding the second substitute. I'll give it a shot. And then I had to talk to my brother. One time when he had to give a message, I said, you know, don't worry about it. God spoke through a donkey once. He can do it again. And that night I had to tell him, okay, you know that donkey thing? You can pray for me this time. So here it goes. In our scripture reading this morning, Jesus was letting the leaders know the heart of worship and also the heart of service. In Mark that Jacob just read, it sums up the Ten Commandments in just two. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And he went on, and also love your neighbors yourself. That sums up the Ten Commandments. If you're focusing on God and others, you're not going to be focusing on yourself. You're going to be willing to serve others. Also, he went on at the end of that to tell about the poor widow, gave everything she had in service and in worship to God. And also in verse 33, it states, it shall be so among you, whoever would be great among you will be your servant. So this servant's heart, what does it look like? I thought we'd look at the biblical, the worldview, too, of a servant's heart. So the world sees greatness in four different P's. First of all is power. So in Matthew 20:25, we read, Jesus called them to him and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. The world sees greatness as authority. The more authority you have, the less people you answer to, the more people you get to boss around. The more rule you have, the more freedom you have to be in charge. So they see power as authority. In the Bible, we see that the power of the tongue, a small little organ, is very beneficial and very destructive. The power of a small rudder behind a great ship can guide it through the waters or can crash it on the rocks. The world also sees part of greatness as having possessions. And in Luke 12:13-19, we see the story of the rich, foolish landowner. And Jesus is there, and someone in the crowd called to him and said, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. But he said to him, Who made me a judge and an arbiter over you? And he said, Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. Okay, he's not only summed up the Ten Commandments, now he's picking out covetousness. And be on guard against this. Life doesn't consist of the abundance of your possessions. And he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. He thought to himself, what should I do? I have nowhere to store my crops. So he said, I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns. Okay, well, he's going to give up the only storage he had. And build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. This man was basing his whole view of greatness on what he had stored up. And you know, he did have much. But if you base your whole view of how great you are on what you have, and Beth mentioned the fires in Arizona. What happens when a fire comes, takes all your possessions? If that's who you are, if that's where you see your importance and your strength and your greatness, it's gone. Your character is who you are, not your possessions. Have you driven around Lincoln much lately? What is on what used to be every vacant lot in town? A storage complex. And now they even have TV shows, people go in and purchase these storage units that are abandoned, that are left sitting. And it's the basis for entertainment. The third P is prestige, and the dictionary defines prestige as widespread respect and admiration for someone or something on the basis of their achievements. Well, this certainly decides King Nebuchadnezzar. Because when we look into Daniel 3, 1-3, we see Nebuchadnezzar observing his kingdom. We see Nebuchadnezzar has created this mammoth statue, 90 feet tall by 9 feet wide, of gold. And if anybody wants to try and do the math of what that would cost, go for it. So he set it up on the plain in Dura in the province of Babylon. Then he said, gather together all the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces. So all the important people, come and see what I've set up. And so the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials gathered together for the dedication of this image to the king. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Nebuchadnezzar thought a lot of himself. And he had a pretty good self-image. Unfortunately, this is not going to be any more lasting than the storage barns of the landowner. The fourth P is position. Again, we go to the dictionary. A person's place or rank in relationship to everyone else, especially in a competitive situation. So, let's look again at the position of King Nebuchadnezzar. The Bible gives us this king as, I mean, he was the king to top all kings. All this came about Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months. He was walking on the roof of his royal palace, and the king answered and said, Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? He thinks a lot about his position. He really thinks a lot of himself. So that's the view from the world. The worldly attitude is selfishness, pride, and I. But the godly attitude is selflessness, humility, and I. We're looking out for others' needs. We are not looking out for our needs. So in Matthew 20:28, this shows us that even though Israel was expecting a reigning king, they wanted somebody to come down, boom, conquer the Romans, and the kingdom is set up. Jesus states that his reason for coming was one of service. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, to give his life a ransom for many. And this one act of service ransomed many, conquered sin and death itself. So the Bible has a great view, great importance on service. And Paul, writing to the Philippians in chapter 2, verses 3-5, shows this important of the attitude of your heart in service. And this is the godly attitude there. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not at his own interests, but the interests of others, having this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ. So now we go back. Let's see. And Paul goes on to show, continuing in Philippians 2, 6-10, talking of Jesus, he says, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God as a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. So, though man, originally, in the garden, was created in the image of God, was created to be God's glory, and for God's glory, the very God of creation came to earth in the image of man. You talk about humility and service. So Jesus teaches that the biblical view of greatness is one of service. So again, we'll use the four P's that the world does. As far as power goes, Jesus finishes his thought in Matthew 20 and verses 26-27 when he states, "Whoever wants to be great among you must serve the rest like a servant." I once heard a quote by Warren Wiersbe, who was headed back to the Bible. He said, the two most important offices, the two most important positions in the church are the usher and the cleaner. If it's not clean, you're not going to want to go in. You're not, I mean, you know, this is what they think of their church? Really? If you're not welcomed by those ushers, by the greeters, you're not going to feel welcome and you're not going to want to return if you do go in. So service and being a servant is the power of biblical teaching. Possessions, when Jesus finished his story and the foolish landowner in Luke 12, 20-21, God said to him, "Fool, on this night your soul's required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up for treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." It used to be a bumper sticker, "He who dies with the most toys wins." Well, that's until the next guy gets the most toys. And he who dies with the most toys still dies without his toys. The stuff here on earth, I've heard it said in a lot of funeral. I used to work a lot of memorial services at Faith Bible, and I heard it said over and over, you never see a hearse with a trailer. Yeah, don't take your toys with you. So possessions themselves are not the issue. The possessions that we have are not the issue. It's your attitude toward those possessions. When Joseph was in Potiphar's court, he stored up many possessions, but it was for the betterment of the nation and the nations around them to be used at a later time. He had the right heart on possessions. God's view of prestige is continued in the story of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 3:19. He felt his prestige, his importance had been dishonored by three young men. They wouldn't bow to his statue. So he takes them. We all know the story. He takes them. He heats up the oven, the blast furnace, to seven times hotter. His own servants die at the door because it's so hot. And he places them in. But then he looks in, and they're unharmed. He was humbled. Not only didn't they die, but when he called out, they didn't even smell of smoke. And he gave up his prestige when he gave honor to God in Daniel 3:28-30. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their body rather than serve and worship any god except their own God." And he wound up promoting them in the nation of Babylon. And finally, position. Again, got to go to King Nebuchadnezzar. His position, he had everything. He had that big statue, showed how important he was. And in Daniel 4:33-35, he dropped just as far as he could drop. Immediately, the word of the Lord was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men. He ate grass like an ox. His body was wet with the dew of heaven until his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. But he was restored again and gave honor to the Lord. And at the end of days, Nebuchadnezzar lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion. The dominion that Nebuchadnezzar held so dear was so fleeting. And this king is crawling around on the grass with long hair, with long fingernails, and eating the grass. What a drop. So in the possessions, these and life itself are fleeting. Prestige, we are what God makes us. And position, God raises kings and brings down kingdoms. When we think of ourselves as more important than we are, God can bring us down and bring us to humility. So in the Bible, God's been gracious enough and kind enough to give us examples. Obviously, the Word says it's written as an example for us. And in Paul in 1 Corinthians 11:1 says, "Be imitators of me as I am of Christ." Okay, that's two pretty good examples. Very selfless human beings that were focused on serving. So looking at the examples that I've chosen, I didn't bring my hat down, sorry, or my poncho. I decided to call them the good, the bad, and the ugly. Taking a Clint Eastwood title there. So obviously we begin the good list with Jesus. You can't get any better example. And we return to Philippians 2:7-8, where it's written, "But he emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of man, being in human form, humbled himself to death on the cross." And in John 6:38, Jesus shows his servant attitude when he states, "For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." He not only served the man, but he came down. His ultimate goal was to serve the Father and to do his will. And the Father's will was that he go to the cross. So he demonstrated his servant heart on the night of the Passover when they were celebrating, and the night before he was arrested, and he washed the disciples' feet. Now, this is a very menial thing for the God of creation to do. Washing of the servant's feet would have been a sign to either a servant or to a slave. If the household didn't have a servant or a slave, it would be the youngest child's duty to wash the feet of the guests. And if the house had no children in it, whoever was lowest on the totem pole status-wise would have drawn this responsibility. Another example of good is Isaiah. We see in Isaiah 6 where he writes, "In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. His train filled the temple, and above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. One called to the other and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The earth is full of his glory.' And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke." And now we see Isaiah looking into himself. And he said, "Woe is me, I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." He saw the glory of God and he realized his shortcomings. He realized the shortcomings of the people that he lived with. Then one of the seraphim, he was a man of unclean lips, the seraphim was going to take care of that. One of the seraphim flew to him, having in his hand a burning coal he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, your sin is atoned for." And I heard a voice of the Lord say, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And Elijah's servant attitudes, then I said, "Here I am, send me." And he said, "Go." His recognition of his unworthiness, of his sin, he realized he was in the power of the greatness of God. And when that was taken care of, when that was taken away, he was willing to go. When the Lord asked who to send, it was "send me." The most senior member of our good list would have to be Noah. In a time when God decided, there's only six chapters into the book. The first three cover the garden. This is only three chapters later, and God's already deciding he should wipe out flesh from the earth. Noah found favor with God. We're not told why. He found favor with God. He proved his favor was well placed when he completed the tasks that God had given him. Build an ark 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet tall, in a land with no water and where it hadn't rained. Yeah, his neighbors thought he was nuts. And he probably took a lot of harassment. And that's a daunting task in itself. Now consider, he started the ark at age 500. And it took 120 years to accomplish. On top of that, he had to gather animals. Seven of each clean male and female animal, and the birds. One of each male and female of unclean animals, and even the creepy crawly things that, you know, he could have just let get washed away. We had four young men on our good list taken into captivity into Babylon when they were just teenagers. Daniel continued to pray in God when the king was tricked into signing an order that he couldn't. His faithful service allowed him to serve and deliver bad news to several kings. Now, delivering bad news to kings is normally fatal, but his faithful service to God was rewarded. He served Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. He served Belshazzar of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, Darius of the Medes, and Cyrus of the Persians. And earlier we talked about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And in Daniel 3, 28 and 30, it tells us that Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach." Because of their faithfulness, God was blessed. And they were promoted. They were rewarded for their faithful service. And it's been a while now, but Deb and I used to run an apologetics group for homeschool kids. And at the end of it was always a speech tournament. Today when Deb came in, she reminded me, "Don't just stand there and read your message. I'm watching you." Okay. It's a good thing this message has been going through my head for weeks. But one of the stories we heard is about a later person, not mentioned in the Bible, but it mentioned in church history, and his name's Polycarp. He was actually a disciple of John. And when he was 86 years old, he was arrested and tried. He refused to renounce his faith, saying, 86 years have I served him. He's done me no wrong. He refused to give up the Savior that he had been serving, that he had been taught about, that he was teaching others about. The sentence, he was to be burned at the stake. And he threw him a twist. A fire ring was quickly built. Ready? I mean, they went out and they found twigs with the help of the Jewish people. They wanted to end this. They wanted to end this thing about Jesus. You know, this was infuriating to them. So when they went to secure him to the post with nails, I got to read this because he had a quote. His response was, "Leave me as I am. He that gives me the strength to endure will enable me not to struggle without the help of your nails." They went to burn him at the stake, and he stood there and let him do it. And when the fire didn't consume his body, they stabbed him to make sure, you know, they were rid of him. I could easily go into more examples straight from this church, but I don't want to embarrass anybody by doing that. So, next we go to the bad list. Balaam, the prophet for profit. A non-Israelite prophet. In Numbers 22, the story begins with King Balak of Moab. And there's a strange people. So Balak, the king of Moab, sent messengers to Balaam. Then the people of Israel settled and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw that all Israel had done to the Amorites and was in great dread of the people because there were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. So this is back before they're in the land. This is back as they're wandering around in the wilderness, and then they conquered Jericho. They saw what they were doing. So he sent his messengers, his princes, up to visit Balaam, because Balaam was his conjurer and he could cast a curse on this strange people. Balaam hadn't heard of Israel, obviously, yet, because when they got up there, he had them lodge with him for the night so he could consult with God on what he should do. And God said, "No, don't go. This is a blessed people." So he said, "Nope, can't go with you," and sent him away. He didn't tell him the whole story that this people was blessed. This people was blessed by the God that, you know, he was prophesying for. So the king sends back another contingent with a higher priced offer, a lot more money. Again, he had them stay with him so he could consult with God. And in verse 20, God gave him different instructions. "If the men come and call you, rise and go with them, but do only what I tell you." The next morning, Balaam gets up early, takes two of his servants, and hops on his donkey, and they go off to curse Israel and to help Balak. Okay, at this point, God's anger is kindled, and I'm going, hold it, I think I missed something. God says, "Yes, you can go." He went and he got mad. So I had to go to a commentary. I'm going, okay, what did I miss? Okay, and here's what that said. Why was the anger of the Lord kindled against Balaam? He went to God again, hoping he'd change his mind that he could go curse this blessed nation. He didn't give him God's full answer and tell him, "No, they're blessed, hands off." He again requested to be able to go curse the people. God said, "If the men come and call you, go." He got up the next morning and went by himself. He didn't wait for them to come and call him. He saddled his donkey and two servants went. Okay, that makes sense now why God was upset. He didn't follow all the instructions. That's why he's the for-profit prophet. Like Lot sitting at the gate, sitting facing the gate of Sodom, then he moves a little closer to the gate. Pretty soon he's in Sodom, and he's rescued just before it falls. So now we get to the point that would make a great sci-fi movie. The angels, or the donkey's trodden down the road, and there's an angel with a sword drawn in front of him, ready to strike him down. So the donkey veers off. What happens? He gets smacked with a rod. And later they go through this little tiny narrow opening between vineyards. The donkey veers off and scrapes Balaam's foot. Again gets smacked with a rod. Okay, this part makes sense. They're going along again. Here is the angel in a part that's area that's too narrow to get through, the donkey just lays down and goes, okay, I give up. Gets off and he smacks him again. The third time he got hit, Balaam had a conversation with the donkey. And he didn't see anything wrong with it. This donkey's talking to him. He does not see anything wrong with it. The donkey said, am I not your donkey on which you've ridden all your life, all life long to this day? Is this normally the way I treat you? And he said, no. And so he should have known something was up. And then Balaam was able to see the angel standing there with the sword drawn. He was in dire, dire straits. And he was still pressing on. In the early church, we have the bad of Ananias and Sapphira, which wouldn't have had to be a bad example. Back in the early church, they were selling their goods, what they had, so that they could bring them to the church. Everybody would have their needs met. So Ananias and Sapphira said, well, let's sell it, this tract of land here. We'll keep part of it, and we'll tell them we sold it for this much. So they come in, and they lay that much at the feet of the apostles. And Peter says, why do you put God to the test? Why do you test the Spirit? While you owned this land, it was yours to do with what you wanted. Not a problem. Once you sold it, the money was yours to do with as you wanted. If they had kept part of it and said, we want to give this much of it, it would have been straightforward and honest. They said, we give it all. What happened to Ananias? He's standing here in front of the apostles, drops dead, and they carry him out. Sapphira comes in. Is this the price you guys sold the land for? Yeah, well, look, those guys just buried your husband, you're next. And she drops dead, and they carry her out. If they had just been honest in their service, they had a good service. They gave money to help the church. But they did it in a dishonest way. So now the ugly. I know these guys don't have ugly stories. These three have good stories, have good service records. They have ugly beginnings and ugly parts of them. So we start with Jonah. He's called and sent to the evil city of Nineveh. I mean, everybody in the area knew Nineveh. It was a bad place to visit. And in 1:1-3, we see, now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, arise, go to Nineveh, the great city. Call out against it, for their evil has come up before me. But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa. He found a ship going to Tarshish. And when he paid the fare, he went on to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. Not a great plan. So while they're out on the sea, a storm hits. And they're trying to figure out who's responsible. The lot falls on Jonah. And they ask him, okay, what's with you? In verse 9, he says to them, I am a Hebrew. I fear the Lord of God, the Lord God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. The God of heaven who made the sea. And I'm running away from him on it. He had a very short, I guess he thought that when God, after God created the sea, he just left it. He didn't do anything with it. He did eventually go to Nineveh. The whale took him a little farther away. Nineveh was not a small city. It took 3 days to walk across. But he did deliver a message, and he wasn't happy about it because he knew God. So in chapter 4, verse 1-3, it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry, and he prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord, is this not what I said? When Nineveh repented, when there was a time of change of attitude, a change of their lives, the king took off his royal robes, put on sackcloth and ashes. He said, isn't this what I said when I was yet in my country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew you're a gracious God, merciful, slow to anger. And now he's trying to kiss up. You know, I know your character. I knew you were going to save him, so why'd you even send me here? This makes me mad. He sat and he watched and waited for Nineveh to be destroyed, and it never was. And God even sent him a couple other illustrations. He sent a plant to shade him, and then he sent a worm to kill the plant. And he says, why are you so worried about this? God had sent him to serve 120,000 in Nineveh who didn't know their right hand from their left. We had some young people. I don't know how many people total were in Nineveh, but he had a lot of young people there that God sent a chance of salvation for. And Jonah tells the Lord, oh Lord, please take my life. It's better for me to die than to live. Okay, you big baby, you know. And that's where it ends. We're not told what happened to Jonah after that. It's a short little book. But we do know that he eventually did serve. He did go to Nineveh and proclaim the message. And the people received the message. Joseph, at the beginning of his story, he's kind of an annoying little stepbrother. In Genesis 37, 2-8, Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report from them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than his other sons because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and they couldn't speak peacefully to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told the brothers the dream, this is when he gets into trouble. He said, hear this dream I dreamed. Behold, we are binding sheaves. Behold, my sheaf rose and stood straight upright, and your sheaves gathered round and bowed down to my sheaf. His brother said, really? Are you saying you're going to rule over us? Well, we know the rest of the story, so yeah. They took him and they sold him into service as a slave to the Midians that were traveling by. They went down to Egypt. He got sold to Potiphar. While being a faithful servant there, he wound up being thrown in jail because he wouldn't succumb to the time that his master's wife came on to him. And he got put in jail. Then the king had a dream, and somebody said, oh, hey, we know somebody who can interpret this for you. It was the dream of the coming famine. Pharaoh released Joseph and promoted him only according to the throne. That's the only place Joseph wasn't greater than the king of Egypt. So through his faithful service, he was promoted and was able to have a plan that saved the people. Paul, okay, another great servant of the Bible, but he started out persecuting the church. He was so zealous, thinking he was serving God, that he was putting people to death, even at the stoning of Stephen. And he wound up being able to write, be imitators of me, as I imitate Christ. In his service, he imitated Christ. So what about us? What kind of service can we have? Right here in our church, we can do Awana. Dan mentioned the prison ministry, if anybody wants to help with that. There can always be volunteers. You can be a prayer warrior. You take our prayer list. You pray for the church. You pray for the people. You pray for the church worldwide. You have around-the-world access to pray for the church. Music specials, worship, different things we have here. You can get on our ministry rotations. You can talk to Sharon. She'll get you on the different ministry rotations. You can reach your neighbors by being a listening ear or providing a meal in hard times. Service and ministry doesn't have to stop here. So, I found some 6 questions here. So let's examine our hearts. So, Matthew 10:42 says, You serve God by serving others. Even if you give a cup of cold water to the least of my followers, you'll be rewarded. God knows what service we do. Now, we got to be careful, because 1 Peter 5 asks, do you serve for the approval and the applause of others, or do you do it for an audience of one? During the prayer time, the religious leaders were out there. I'm glad I'm not like this guy. You know, I'm pretty good here in the church. And they would do things to be seen. This tax collector was off praying, be merciful to me. He knew he was in the wrong. So do you serve for the approval? If you serve for the approval of man's applause, you've got it. Congratulations. If you serve for God's blessing, you don't bring attention to yourself. So, do you make yourself available to serve? Do you pay attention to needs? Do you see the needs of others? Do you do the best with what you have? Are you a good steward? Are you a good servant with what God's given you? Do you do every task with equal dedication, or ones, okay, here at church, yeah, I'm going to put my all into it. At work over here, it's kind of boring. I don't really like my job, so no, I'm only going to do part-time. I had a boss one time that told me, he didn't tell the employees under me. He said, you know, they don't pay real well around here. You're here 8 hours. As long as you put in six, you're good. But yeah, he would not have given that same option to the others. Are you faithful to the ministry God's called you to serve in? And do you maintain a low profile? Are you serving, there again, are you serving for the approval of one or many? Lumiere in Disney's Beauty and the Beast had a great take on servanthood. Life is so unnerving for a servant who's not serving. He's unwhole without a soul to wait upon. If we're not serving, then we are not in God's will. If there had been an eighth letter in the list of churches in Revelation, I believe it would have been written to Faith Bible Church, or to Firth Bible Church. Did I? Yeah, I typed it right. Giving condemnation for your service to one another. We have a church that truly serves one another. It's often said that in church, 80% of the work is done by 20% of the people. We don't have that. Last week I went down to go ahead and start setting up the tables for our lunch. And they were there. Tablecloths on. And I didn't even know what was going on. So, when history records names for the next generation, will we be listed among the good, the bad, or the ugly?